1888 Podcast Network.
New year, new programs. If you like listening to the How the Why, check out our new podcasts, including the Hero's Journey podcast, hosted by Jeff Garvin and Dan Zarzana. Listen to Jeff and Dan study character through the lens of Joseph Campbell by breaking down your favorite books and films. Go to 1888.center/podcast to listen, or subscribe at iTunes. I did.
I'm John Barrett Ingalls, and this is The How, The Why, presented by 1888. Every week, we connect with artists, authors, and innovators in the world of publishing and literature to discuss their creative process and creative purpose, and explore the evolution of the industry. 1888 serves as a regional catalyst for the preservation, presentation, and promotion of cultural heritage and literary arts. Let's get connected.
Hello and welcome to the How the Why, brought to you by 1888. My name is John Barrett Ingalls, and today we are connected with Michael Heald, the owner of Perfect Day Publishing and writer and running enthusiast. And we'll get to that in a little bit as well. But Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
You're welcome.
So I want to start with... I've read a couple of your articles from Runner's World, and I'd love to know how you got started in the world of journalism and writing, and if it was a love of running or if that was a job that led to an appreciation for running.
It was pretty unintentional, actually. I didn't aspire to write for Runner's World. I did subscribe when I was a teenager and serious about high school cross country. And actually, I was just looking to pad my own book. And it was 2012. The Olympic trials have been held a few times in Eugene over the last decade. And I approached via Facebook a former Olympian, Ian Dobson, who I had competed against in high school, who was much better than me. And I proposed that I described it as we should do a David Foster Wallace style piece about you and your final professional race. And it ended up being, I just was very fortunate. The whole thing, it had to do with his then wife, Julia Lucas, who just missed making the team in 2012 by 0.04 seconds. And I, of course, hadn't foreseen that she would be at the center of this dramatic thing. And so I had a front row seat where Ian and I were getting together periodically during the trials to talk about, his feelings. And I wrote a 40-page essay about it that a friend of mine published online. And then a week later, basically I got an email from Runner's World asking if I'd be interested in writing for them, because there had been a lot of traffic based on the fact that Julia had been in this super competitive race.
And right.
Yeah. So suddenly I was I had the opportunity to get paid to write really for the first time.
Where was that article posted originally?
Propeller Magazine. My friend Dan DeWeese publishes Propeller, which is both an online magazine, and they put out one book of fiction every year.
Okay.
Yeah. And kudos to Dan for editing a 14,000 word essay in his spare time. That really changed my life. So,
All right. So now I have a couple of questions based off of what you said. So Propeller Magazine, is that a connection to Propeller Books as well?
It is, yeah.
And Propeller Books is who releases the books from Perfect Day Publishing, correct?
We are teaming up. They are distributing us.
Distributing, okay.
Yeah. So Perfect Day is its own company, but Propeller is now a collective of several Pacific Northwest small presses.
Now talk a little bit about, we'll get back to the running. So you said you were working on a book and looking for pieces. Yeah, this is Goodbye to the Nervous Apprehension. Was this the book that you were working on at that time?
Right. Yeah. And I wanted to get into, because a lot of that book is about my 20s. and I wanted to get into my high school years. And so that I kind of went about it in this sideways, roundabout way, where running had been the thing I cared the most about when I was a teenager. So, so again, that's why that story happened. But yeah.
Where did the start of, or the passion for writing, or like the curiosity or the urge to tell these stories? When did that begin?
Well, I'd always loved reading. Like when I was 7 or 8, there was some, I don't know if it was a competition, but the local public library, you know, you got to submit how many books and the titles of the books you'd read over the summer. And I like had read more than anybody else. I think it was both like, I've always been a little bit of a competitive person, but as a kid, reading was its own thing, and it still kind of is. But somewhere around the end of high school, I started reading good novels, and like Catch 22 and a book like that just changed my life, and Vonnegut, and just seeing that there, that you can have fun with writing and yet get at these serious topics. I'd say I didn't really start writing until I was in college, but I had plans, you know, I had plans for a couple of years that I'd sit down and start writing stories.
Do you go to school for writing or for creative writing?
Sort of. I went to Wesleyan University, and there, I had a lot of opportunities to take workshops there. Starting, I think my sophomore year was my first workshop. And actually my mentor there just recently passed away, Kit Reed, who's an amazing sci-fi writer and a mentor to like Joss Whedon and Lemony Snicket. So I'm very low on the totem pole of people that whose lives she really influenced. But I was lucky that Kit took me under her wing.
Was it always a focus on more of the nonfiction style, or
no? I wrote fiction exclusively throughout my 20s, and published one short story. Like, you know, wrote a novel that I tried to sell to a bunch of agents. That was a pretty brutal experience, and I had moved. I was living in San Francisco for the first few years after college, and saved up. I was teaching and saved up to fund essentially like 1 year in Central America. I lived in Nicaragua, and that's where I wrote my novel. Came back to the States. It was 2008. The market crashed when I was trying to sell it, and I didn't sell it, and ended up kind of stepping away from writing for a couple years. And by the time I decided I wanted to really pursue it again with even more like seriousness, that was 2010, and that's when Perfect Day kind of started.
Now let's talk a little bit about the inception of Perfect Day. Was it a looking for a home to put your work, or had writer friends of yours reached out to you? How did the whole thing come about?
It came about really quickly, in that I wanted to. Basically, like I thought at first I wanted to start a journal. I wanted to get something going in Portland that resembled, like I've been a musician at times in my life, and I have friends who are far more talented than I am in that area. And I just was sort of taking cues from some of my friends who are making, still are making great music in Portland, and wanted to start something that looked like a label, but for writing. And that summer of 2010 was when I heard about this year-long program at the Independent Publishing Resource Center, which is an ongoing thing. It's incredibly affordable. Like basically it's a, I encourage any listeners who are on the fence about whether or not an MFA is A, worth moving for or like investing money in, to look at the IPRC as a totally different option. And so, I heard about the program, applied to it, and at right around the same time, a friend of mine, Lisa Wells, had just published this great short story, and I basically solicited a book of essays from her, because she also was working on these pieces about like the Portland of 2010, 2011, which no longer exists. So it's a bit of a time capsule, but Lisa was the guinea pig. I learned a ton over the course of the next year, and we put out her book, Yeah, No, Totally, in 2011. And I just want to plug, she's got two books coming out in the next 2 years. She won the Iowa Poetry Prize for The Fix, which comes out next year. And then Believers is her FSG debut, which comes out in 2019, which is a collection of nonfiction. Yeah, so it's like, I mean, you know, Lisa was a great talent back then, and I'm not surprised at all that she's like legit these days at all. So, but at the same time, it is really nice to step back and see that you're right about people. And yeah.
So tell me about some of what you learned with the first book and some of the challenges you faced and overcame.
Well, I still do the interior design for all the Perfect Day books. And at that time I had taken one InDesign class, which is the Adobe program you use for layout. And I laid out that entire book as one text box. So if anybody, if you're familiar at all with InDesign, like, you know, this is insanity that each piece should have its own text box that you can adjust and change things. So the whole thing was like incredibly, it was a very like fraught experience where I was really afraid that when it went to print that there was going to be some terrible mistake. And I just felt like too deep into it to redo it. So and I think with The Stranger up in Seattle, when they reviewed the book, they sort of made a very gentle criticism of my layout decision because like also the text is huge. It was a very short book, so I was trying to make it look longer. And I think I've learned to make the books look like professionally designed. And that took a few times, honestly. But so like that, just as far as the nuts and bolts of making a book, I feel like I'm a lot better at that. But also just I think what I've learned from the get-go is that I like that experience of sort of diving into a project with the writer at an early point in the writing process and helping guide some of the conceptual stuff about what is this book going to be and structurally what is it going to look like, instead of taking completed manuscripts. So every book we've done, except for, I think you had Zachary Auburn on your show.
Yes, we did, yeah.
Yeah, so his book was a reissue, and he did that all himself with an illustrative friend's help.
It's anonymous.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually just like a month ago put his name on our website for the first time because he's been publishing under it. And I'm like, okay, it's fine.
Yeah, we talked about that a little bit about like, when are you going to own up? And he said, well, my publisher said I need to start owning up on all of these. So, what about like the distribution at the beginning? And like, I know we've talked about you partnered with Propeller Books, but like the choice to avoid Amazon and to avoid any online sales, is that Propeller Books?
Yeah, I love online sales if they come through my website, you know, which more and more I feel like that's becoming a thing that people are comfortable, you know, ordering from a publisher versus like looking to Amazon first.
Right.
But yeah, it's a work in progress. I mean, I know I've sacrificed sales over the years. But I'm a big believer, like anytime I go to another city, I try to go to as many stores as possible. It's kind of an excuse to go like chat with booksellers and try to convince them, you know, like I'll wheel in my books. I'm not kidding. Like I was in San Francisco a few months back and had my roller bag with me, you know, with a box of books, and was selling like three or four copies to my favorite stores in the Mission. And I mean, I don't make a living off of this, and I just tried to make sure each book breaks even. And I don't know what will happen in the future with Perfect Day, you know, in terms of the finances, but I think because I have never depended on it for like my rent, I decided early on that not selling on Amazon was important enough to me.
Sure.
They obviously like have business practices that harm neighborhood brick and mortar bookstores. And, you know, I think you can establish relationships with certain stores that believe in your work and will put your books in a prominent place. And, you know, I've seen stores outside of the Northwest sell a lot of our books, and every time it's a roll of the dice though. I mean, like we've sent off a bunch of copies of the new book just over the last week. You know, it comes out next week, and you just never know. But I do think that those individual relationships with booksellers matter a lot in terms of, you know, having a hit.
No, what does that look like? What is the sales process of walking into, you know, a bookstore, especially one that's outside of the Pacific Northwest? I'm going to pick one of these off your list, like going to Argo Bookshop in Montreal.
Argo, I don't know if they still have any of our books, but I did a reading there at the end of my own book tour back in 2013, because I love Montreal. And in fact, actually, Montreal was where I hatched the idea for becoming a publisher. I was in Montreal like 7 years ago for a friend's wedding, and I was like, boy, I really wish I could live here. And then if I lived in Montreal, what would I do? Oh, I would be a publisher. And then I got back to Portland, and I was like, I guess I could just do that here. But as far as contacting them, that was over email. You know, the in-person sales, there's a store in Oakland called E.M. Wolfman, I think they're called. Okay. And I showed up there right at opening, like noon, let's say, back in early June when I was in town, and just hung out because nobody was there. And then I can't remember the guy's name, but he's not the owner, but he works there. He had a flat tire. He like walked up with his, you know, bike with a flat tire. And I'm like, immediately, you try to be charming, but you also have to know that it's a business for these stores, and they're doing you a giant favor by taking your books, even on consignment.
Sure. And so you have to be a salesman of sorts.
Totally, yes. And I've learned, I have developed a much thicker skin around this. Like, I was in Denver visiting family last weekend, and my aunt came with me to various stores, and actually having her along, she, you know, she's a big fan of mine. And having her along, I felt like those were the best interactions I've ever had. So maybe I need to recruit her to come on more trips with me.
Well, I wonder how important it is to, like, because a lot of the smaller bookstores, like the books that sell the most are staff favorites. So exactly. How important is it to get the books into the hands of the staff after getting them in the store in the first place?
Yeah, well, I think the way that I do it, which is a very inefficient way, it does guarantee that this, like, at least certain staff are aware of the book, right. You know, and when they, like, I just sent off a box to Green Apple Books in San Francisco, and, you know, I when I lived there, that was my store, and so that means a lot to me to even know that there are going to be a handful of copies there, and maybe it'll be a staff pick, and maybe there'll be, like, a shelf talker kind of thing underneath it, and, like, you know, like, it's good to step back at times and remind myself that that should be enough. Like, I, like, you know, when it's a break-even operation, like, these are real successes.
Sure.
And you never know who the people are who are going to end up buying the book.
So. And as far as, like, early release, you send out to different journals and to get reviews, and how do you get your blurbs as well? Is that all just on you?
No, with Sung's book, that was all Sung. Like, I don't know. It really depends from writer to writer how the blurb process works. But usually, I think, like, this process resembles the way a larger publisher would work, where it's like you talk to the writer and you're like, "What writers do you know? And who are your favorite writers? Like, who should we send this to? Who are, like, the long shot people?" And then you just you know, I think we printed like 7 or 8. Super advanced copies back in July for blurbers. And, you know, I finally have nailed down the calendar of, like, how to get a book ready for a fall release, because it finally occurred to me, as somebody who I, like, published Nick Jaina's book in January. Like, I was like, that was a bad time to publish a book. Like, it did great. But in terms of, like, bookstores, like, if you can get it on shelves right now, you know, then this is the time that the majority of people are going to be buying books over the course of the year. So the next 2 months.
So I'm curious, I want to, like, talk about the process. You said that you rarely get, except for Zachary's book, completed manuscripts. And even, you know, reading through Sung's book, What About the Rest of Your Life, which was brilliant and heartbreaking and challenging to read, but beautiful. And a lot of the book it seems like it's written as it's being published. So I was going to ask you about that anyway, because she has, you know, letters to the publisher, and it's fascinating. But that's the process. That's your process of taking more of a concept or an idea and or an essay and expanding it. Or how do you work?
Just songs pronouns are they and them.
Sorry, I apologize.
But I mean, I'm just attracted to nonfiction. Oh, and I never really answered that question of like how I got into nonfiction in the first place, because I was resistant to it as somebody who tried and kind of failed as a fiction writer. But the immediacy of nonfiction and the sort of the sense of discovery through the process of writing is what attracts me to it, especially as an editor. And so, like with Sung's book, it's divided into three sections, as you're aware. And the first section was mostly written back in December of last year when we hatched the idea for the book. And then everything after that is new. And I mean, I just think that as a small press, this is the one area where I have a huge advantage over, like, you know, the regular presses, is that we can put out work that is super, super fresh. And so the writer's more excited about it. It feels different, like, especially considering what's happened in the last 12 months. I think this book has just a, without being overtly political, like there's just a sense of it happening, as you said, like kind of right now. And I also just think, like, as somebody who's a writer myself, like it's hard to get excited for readings if it's old work. And so when you're sending somebody off on a book tour, and the work was written in like May and they're on tour in November, that just like looks and feels different, I think, to an audience than a book that got written 2 years ago.
Right.
But the process is like with Sung is the first non-Portlander I published, and they live in Chicago. And so it was many, 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 many hours on the phone, which was a lot of fun, honestly, looking back. We did a lot of edits through track changes, you know, in Microsoft Word. But eventually, as we got close to the deadline, it became more like I would have the book up on my computer and we would just be on the phone for 2 hours, like talking through sentences. And it's really fun to sort of get a glimpse inside somebody else's mind, as like someone would just be like rewriting out loud over the phone to me. And to me, like, it's just like, it's kind of thrilling to work with people who are better writers than I am, and, you know, like, just like make decisions in a different kind of way, and getting to sort of see behind the curtain in that respect is a giant reward for running this press.
How did they get in contact with you in the first place? How did Sung get in contact with you?
Oh, I got in contact with them. I solicit books almost always. Like, that's how it has.
There's nothing, you don't accept submissions at all.
I'm the worst at rejecting people. I don't do it. I prefer not to do it. And so, and also as basically a one man operation most of the year, in terms of just like the day to day running a Perfect Day, like I can't keep up with the emails, that I would be getting if I accepted submissions. And so, yeah, so I've just generally reached out to people whose writing I've admired, or people I've known in some capacity in Portland. But in Sung's case, my friend Corinne, who actually designed the Perfect Day logo way back when we got started, Corinne had founded an online journal called the James Franco Review, which was obviously like a tongue-in-cheek name, in that the James Franco Review is like blind submissions only, and Corinne would bring on a guest editor for each issue, like for the prose, the poet, like different editors for each genre. And so about a year and a half ago, Alyssa Washuda, who recently lived in Seattle and now is at Ohio State, selected Sung's piece, which is basically the opening piece of the book. And so when I read that, I was like, this is an amazing writer. Mm. And also, like, as soon as you go down the rabbit hole of like Googling, like, has this person published elsewhere? Sung had published like three other things. And I was like, something tells me, A, that they don't have a book deal yet, and B, like, they're going to be hungry enough if I offer them the opportunity to put out a book next year that we can do it. And so like that, you know, I'm sitting at the same desk I was at back in December when I called up Sung and we talked about it and, you know, probably spent an hour on the phone just talking about the process and what it was going to look like. And yeah, they were on board. And so like literally like 5 days later, I get the first like chunk of new writing, which some of which found its way into the finished version of What About the Rest of Your Life. And so, yeah, it's just been, it's kind of a mad dash every time, but I just find it really rewarding. And I mean, I don't know if people believe me when I say this, but I feel the same sense of connection to the work of every writer I publish that I feel like my own book doesn't really look any different to me on when they're all stacked next to each other. Like I put as much work into these other books almost as my own writing. So.
And are you the sole editor for everything that Perfect Day publishes?
Yeah, I mean, everybody I've published has had other readers. So I don't want this to sound like no one reads the book other than me. But like Song's friend Vaughn played a big part in some edits throughout the process. But as far as like the final cut, it's just between me and the authors. Yeah.
And how long do you usually take? I mean, it's one book a year. So do you usually take the majority of that year to work with the author?
That's the way it's looked the last few years. I also just should give a shout out to our copy editor, Jesse Carver, who's a very dear friend of mine, who also, especially with this book, Jesse became far more like she did some developmental edits. And so, yes, I get a lot of help from talented people. Yeah, as far as the way my year looks, so I bartend to make a living, and which allows me a lot of daytimes free, you know, which is when my brain works best. And I a lot of this year, you know, like you're kind of waiting for new work to be sent. And I didn't really start working super, super hard on the book till May, and then May through like early August is editing and then design and working with my friend Aaron designs the covers, and he puts a ton of time into cover design. And then after that, it's all promotion. So basically like starting like in January, I'll have a few months where like theoretically I could really dedicate myself to my own writing. So we'll see if I come up with anything good during that time. But I've learned that it's okay to not write for large chunks of the year, and that especially like now that I've got 7 books in our catalog and I'm seeing them like stack up, it's like one book a year may look and seem slow to other people, but to me like it's starting to feel like a lot of stuff. So
sure, because then once it's out, it's about the promotion and the you know, getting the word out and the sales and marketing, and it's a business.
It is, yeah. And I mean, I would love for it to become a source of income for myself. But I don't know. I mean, there's a job I may or may not apply for that I'm not sure that I would take if I got with the publisher in New York, you know, which I probably wouldn't get. But it has Melville House. So I'll just
put
it
out there.
I probably not apply for the job because I'm afraid that I would have to move. But it has crossed my mind that it's like what I'm doing may position me to like eventually become part of some other publisher. But I also, you know, just having been at the kind of the mercy of other companies, like at various points in my life, being in charge of something seems really valuable. And so I wouldn't let Perfect Day go, without a lot of like deep thinking first.
Well, I'm sure that you feel, and maybe I'm putting words into your mouth, but there is like a sense of loyalty to the place as well, right? I mean, you said a majority of your authors are Portland or Pacific Northwest mm-hmm. based. Does the place itself play into a role of your work?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I moved here when I was 11 years old, and then graduated high school, moved away, like didn't really want to stick around in Portland, which it's funny to look back because like I graduated high school in 1999 and Elliot Smith had gone to the same high school a decade earlier, and he was he was in Portland when I was a teenager, and I like had no awareness of him. And I was like, the city sucks, you know. And I wanted to go somewhere bigger and more exciting. And then moving back in 08 and really establishing some roots here and some roots in the arts communities, I couldn't recreate this, like what the community I have here anywhere else at this stage in the same way where, like, you know, I have friends who are just like brilliant musicians, and I share an office with my friend Casey Jarman, who had been first the music editor of one of our weekly papers and then the managing editor of The Believer, and then he was freelancing for a while, and our office is in the train station. So he wrote this book on death that came out a year ago, and we don't overlap that often, but like we have an office in the Union Station, like along, you know, the wing with the Amtrak, you know, employees and above baggage claim. And it's just bonkers to me that, like, A, it's really cheap, the city owns the building, and B, like, we get to have this kind of space to do our stuff, and that there's enough support that it feels real. And I think I also want to say that Powell's books.
I was going to bring that up as well. Yeah, there is definitely a sense of literary history in Portland.
But just that, with in terms of the nitty gritty numbers of it, like Powell sells a ton of books, and if we were in a similarly sized city without Powell's, I don't know. I mean, I'd probably like figure out a way to make it work, but like Powell sells so many more books than any other store we work with, so it's like this sort of like home field advantage that being a Portland publisher gives you.
Well, I've connected through this podcast with a lot of people from the Portland area as well, and other small presses and journals, and it's pretty incredible the scene that is exists and growing there. It's kind of what we're trying to do in Orange County right now as well. But it's also funny, and I was going to see if you saw a correlation, like reading through your articles and like thinking about the Nike factory and Steve Prefontaine and like how running itself has a strong, especially distance running, has a strong history in that area as well. Like, is there, this is a broad question maybe, but is there, do you see any connection or correlation of why both that literary scene and this running world are able to exist in this part of the country, or not able to exist, but thrive?
Well, I mean, I think they're fueled by different things. I guess if you go back to like the early days of Nike, that company looked pretty different than it does now.
Sure.
I mean, I think the reason that writers and small press people like have thrived over the last decade in Portland had a lot to do with low rent and like low cost of living, where, and also the fact that like there was like a sort of the aspirations among people in their like 30s and 40s even, and like older, were not to necessarily make a lot of money in Portland, and that has definitely changed in terms of like it has just become a harder place to live off of a smaller amount of money. But as far as like the Northwest, if there's some sort of, I don't know, I think Ken Kesey is like he's a really interesting influence for a lot of different kinds of people, and the fact that he was like a wrestler and kind of a jock, mm-hmm. well, like this genius writer who is really connected to place. I mean, I think when I read Sometimes a Great Notion, I was studying abroad in England, and I suddenly was like, I just want to be back in the Northwest and like write about the Northwest. And I think having a connection to the literature and like understanding it on some sort of fundamental level, probably like there's something that transcends like genre or like, it, you know, like athletes probably feel it too, you know, that there's some sort of poetry to being in like old growth forests.
Yeah. No, and, every time I go up there, I feel that too.
Yeah.
And if you're going to run, you want to run where there's lots of oxygen and lots of trees producing oxygen.
Yeah. No kidding.
how do you fit? So you talked a little bit about your job and balancing it with the press. How do you fit your journalistic work into that as well?
Well, I mean, it comes and goes as far as the work I've gotten from Runner's World. And I did a few pieces also for Running Times, which folded, which were more just like a straightforward sports writing, which I actually really enjoyed doing. But yeah, my when I have had assignments, they've often taken a long time. Like the piece I did on the Oregon State Penitentiary took 6 months to write. And I was working on like finishing touches of Nick Jaina's book around the same time, but it's pretty difficult to juggle both things. And so what I have found is that when I'm like super motivated and putting out, you know, put it just like really dedicating my time towards Perfect Day stuff, that I kind of let my own writing go. And the nice thing though, when I've had work from Runner's World, is they pay well enough that I can take off like weeks at a time, from bartending and just like feel like a writer, kind of around the clock. And that often looks really inefficient, you know, like I'm sure like I'm not the only person who wastes a lot of the day before like kind of getting down to the real work. But I do find with the kind of journalism I've done, which is heavily based on like on interviews, that having like just like a really large amount of transcribed like conversation to start with is always really helpful. And always like there's some entry into a scene, before I know it, you know, right. I'll just be rereading like what are the pull quotes from like this conversation I had, and suddenly I'll be writing. And I love that moment where there's no awareness that you're actually now writing, and just transcribing. So yeah, that's always a trick. Like I feel like in terms of journalism is you don't think you're actually going to be writing that day, and then suddenly it's like, oh, I just wrote like the opening scene.
Yeah. Here's 300 words already done.
Yeah.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. What about the rest of your life? Is by Sung Yim is released next month. So everybody, please go to Perfect Day Publishing and check out the book. It, like I said, it is beautiful and tragic and heartbreaking, but a very important read. Your piece on the Runner's World, The Wall, is phenomenal. So I encourage everybody to check out Runner's World and I mean all of your pieces, but that one was beautiful. Michael, thank you again. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us.
Hey, it was a lot of fun. And I really appreciate, you discovering our tiny little press.
This has been The How, The Why with John Barrett Ingalls. The show is produced by Kevin Stanek and yours truly, with production assistance by Sarah Becker. The How the Why theme music was composed and performed by Dan Record. Please consider supporting 1888 and our mission. Become an 1888 advocate by purchasing our books, participating in our programs, and pledging today. For more information, visit 1888.center. That's 1-888-Center. I want to remind you all to keep making art. Thank you.